Now, I noticed that a lot of Victorians are particularly reflecting on meaning of life issues, given that you all went through such a hard time and really behaved so magnificently. Claire Wright, the Victorian historian, has been reflecting on, you know, whether it all seemed worth it at all with the lockdown. So has moral philosopher Raymond Gaita. He's tackled the pandemic and our responses to it, the lives versus livelihoods debate, which has been very vexing for decision makers and for the rest of us, I think. And he's put all his thoughts down into an essay for the summer edition of Meanjin, which is where Claire Wright's piece is too, the 80th anniversary edition, as we discussed last week with Jonathan Green. Ray Gaita is Emeritus Professor of Moral Philosophy at King's College London and Honorary Professorial Fellow at the Melbourne Law School at the University of Melbourne. And he joins us now from central Victoria, where he's been mowing grass. Hardly a lofty activity, but thank you for taking a break, Ray.
No, thank you. It's a great pleasure to be talking with you again.
The triaging concept for COVID, it's something medical people have to do all the time, of course, prioritise. But with a pandemic, that can mean a serious crisis and pressure on resources, and somebody might have to miss out on, say, a hospital bed or a ventilator. And you believe that unearths some common presumptions which are worth looking at. Can you develop that idea, please?
Yes, but I should perhaps declare an interest, which is that I'm 74.
Right.
In fact, I was very reluctant to write about this, partly because I'm 74 and might be perceived to have that interest. Certainly, I felt very conscious of being answerable to somebody who says to me, who is not only 74 but have been living on this country property and suffered none of the real hardships of the lockdowns in Victoria, being answerable to someone who says, well, it's all very well for you to speak. But one of the reasons I did want to say something is because it was prompted by seeing a program on Q&A where a woman, Rosemary Kayes, she's a quadriplegic, and she said that when she heard some of the discussions about triaging, that she felt, as she put it, hit in the face, felt expendable, felt as though she wasn't treated as quite real. And one of the things I wanted to stress in what I wrote is that you could agree with triaging and not feel that you'd been treated as expendable or as not quite real or not fully a person or not fully part of the full human community, depending on the spirit in which it was done.
Would you agree?
I certainly hope I would. I think I should. I put it a bit satirically in the piece I wrote that if the young person who was going to be the beneficiary of getting the respirator and say to me, good on you, old man, you've done the right thing, you've done your civic duty, your quality of life wasn't up to much and you've only got a year or two of it anyhow. I think I say then I snatch the ventilator back.
I just want to dwell upon that. Why? What would be wrong with that spirit?
It's not just the spirit in which that young person might receive it, but it's really the spirit in which a society acts in this regard. That was actually my main concern. I go on to discuss the claim that some people have made. Kerry O'Brien, in fact, on a Q&A program, and Helen Garner wrote a very fine essay on the fact that after a certain age, you become more or less invisible to younger people. In our society, that is, it's notable that it's not the case in Indigenous societies
In terms of the age issues, in fact, you think the pandemic has exacerbated intergenerational tensions, don't you?
Yes, I think it does. I think it's true that a lot of older people feel that younger people have been insufficiently careful about protecting them. And perhaps more importantly, that younger people are resentful of the undoubted burdens that they will have to suffer as a consequence of lockdowns, which were primarily to protect people who are regarded as vulnerable. And as someone who has been a teacher all my life, and also I have children and grandchildren, this has dismayed me greatly. I certainly don't think, for example, that young people are selfish when they party at the beach in large numbers and so on. But I sometimes do think they may not fully understand what they're doing. And this is, I give an example of this. So it's not a matter of blame here at all. But the point I really want to emphasize was that you can take different attitudes to the hardships that you will suffer. And the difference will be often a consequence of the ethical perspective that you take. And if you live in a society in which old people are condescended to, then you're much more likely to be resentful of the consequences you suffer because they have been protected than you would be if you lived in a society in which that wasn't the case.
Right. So you're really talking about community values.
Yeah, exactly. When people do talk about the balancing of lives and livelihood and the consequences that will be suffered by future generations, then it really does depend on whether that future generation has reason to be resentful to the way in which what we call the vulnerable were protected, or whether they say, no, of course, we're not resentful. There's no question they should have been. These will be very, very different attitudes depending on the ethical perspectives that people have.
Well, okay. Look, you give the hypothetical example of someone, a young man who goes partying during the pandemic, hears the advice but doesn't really think it applies to him, and then gets the virus and doesn't intend to but gives it to his mother, who dies. And you really wrestled with this man's, in fact, you had quite a lot about remorse. It was very interesting, I thought, the way you discussed remorse and how that loving father in that family might react to that son who'd come to realise that he'd been cavalier, shall we say, in a way neglectful of a serious intent. You know, that seemed to me to be a very pertinent discussion.
Yeah, well, the point of that discussion, it was triggered by what struck me as the very clumsy and slightly incoherent way in which Daniel Andrews and Sutton were talking about blame. One minute they would blame, next minute they say, no blame, no blame. And I wanted to bring out that you could think that someone had done something morally very serious. In fact, I say of the young person in my discussion, that he says, I've killed my mother. And then I discuss whether that could be possibly a serious attitude, given that it was unintentional. And in important respects, he didn't know what he was doing. But I wanted to say, look, his father takes that description of what he did seriously. He doesn't say, no, you didn't. Don't be silly. That's over the top. In the way, in fact, I say his young friends might say. But I wanted to say he could take that description of what the young person did very seriously and feel terrible sorrow for what that person had morally become by virtue of doing that, but not be in the slightest bit pointing the finger or what we call judgmental. And so I wanted to say the whole question of blame here, and this goes back to what I said a moment ago. I don't think of young people as being selfish when they do the sorts of things that make people think, oh, my God, it's now going to spread. I don't think that. But you can say, look, this is a very morally serious issue without, in fact, taking a judgmental attitude to it. And I wanted to emphasise that. You can have what I call a severe sorrow. And the reason I call it severe is because you insist, yes, this is what you've done. Don't pretend it's something else. But it's sorrowful and compassionate.
One of the things you didn't discuss and which actually preoccupied me, we all had our different preoccupations, I suppose, living through this remarkable year, was, I suppose, the argument that was made in Melbourne during the big lockdown by various key people in medical faculties and so on, that actually the idea that you can have a risk-free, completely risk-free public environment, if only people sort of would behave, is not something that medical people think is wise to put out there, that life is full of risk, random events, and that obviously there's prudence here, but that You know, I think as one man we had on from the Dean of Medicine at Melbourne University said, you know, if we really want to have a risk-free life around motor vehicles, we wouldn't ever drive, but we accept a qualified risk when we get into a car. That made me think a lot about how much risk we just accept into our lives in normal times and how it might inform us as we emerge from this pandemic, how we get back to a rational assessment of risk.
Oh, well, there are risks and risks. And look, I used to be a mountaineer when I was younger, and I still drive four-wheel drives up sand dunes in the desert at risk of my life. So I'm not risk averse. But I feel like saying when people say this sort of thing, do you want to say that because we take a risk when we go to the beach or drive our car or get up on a ladder to fix the guttering, we should be prepared to be a society like Italy with its mass graves? I mean, I confess I don't understand this. I know that Australia, we were very lucky in part because we're an island, and we're very lucky, in fact, that our politicians acted as well as they did. But every night you saw mass graves in all sorts of places. And I want to say, do you want us to risk being a society in which, because we want to go out and enjoy seeing our friends, our grandchildren, having a coffee, and more seriously, a society in which businesses won't fail and so on? So I found that hard to take seriously. But this is why in my piece I try to imagine a conversation between someone who had a small business working for 20 years or had to fire so many people and it was heartbreaking and so on, and a conversation with someone like Rosemary Kayes or someone who was about to die in a hospital of COVID, which is not just dying, it's dying in a terribly horrible way. If I could speak personally here, the thing that terrified me to some degree sometimes about the epidemic was the way my wife would die alone. I wasn't worried about myself. So I think that's very important. So you imagine a conversation in which the person with the business says, look, for the sake of my business, I want you to take this chance. And then he says, oh, not for me, of course, but for all the other businesses that might go under. But the point I make then in the argument is that it's no good gesturing to a large number of others, because each person in that group of others has to ask the same question, imagine the same conversation. I don't say I know exactly where that goes to. But it's very interesting, and I'm sure that nobody would say on their own behalf, oh, of course, for the sake of my small business, you should go under. But it should be for the sake of all the others. But all the others have to imagine the same conversation.
Yes, yes. Look, I want to finish with one of the other big issue of the year, which was the US election, which, of course, has left us almost continually gobsmacked. And it looks like, you know, finally there is a proper recognition that Joe Biden is president. What did you take out of that past year, Ray?
Well, I was in many ways completely bewildered. And I still feel I can't entirely find my feet with what's happened. But what has really shocked me, and that I, in a way, I don't understand, maybe because I'm just ignorant, is the behaviour of the Republican Party going along with Trump in pouring buckets of excrement, really, on the traditions of democratic politics. That I don't understand. Almost two-thirds, I think, of the party, right only a week or so ago, agreed with a Texas governor to take a case to the Supreme Court, hoping to overturn the votes of millions of Americans. And this is what I don't understand.
I think it's extraordinary as a reflection on power and the prospect of it, and the clearly something to do with the horror of the thought of losing it, which I thought, you know, was built into presumptions about democratic politics, but it's certainly been It's certainly been turned on its head and challenged us, I think, watching that that last few years.
Yes, it has, and who knows what the consequences will be. But the whole point about, as it were, conventions rather than just laws is that they take a long time to develop, to become internalised in a society, and they are also very, very fragile. And what Trump has shown and the Republicans have shown is how easily they can be cast aside, and they won't easily rebuild.
Well, I suppose that is exactly what we'll see. Look, Raymond Gaider, it's been fabulous to have you on. You can resume your grass mowing and have a lovely Christmas. Thank you very much indeed.
And you too. Thank you very much, Geraldine.
Professor Raymond Gaider, he's a moral philosopher and he's the author of many, many things, including the memoir Romulus, My Father. His latest is an essay called COVID, Quality and a Common World in the summer edition of Meanjin.